Check, check, 1, 2. Turn that down. Am I coming through now? Can you hear me? Thank you. You are listening to WUSB Stony Brook, and it is time for lunch on Thursday, and I am seeing myself in the meter now. So let's do that fancy opening with Bill McNulty. Here we go. So Bill waited so long trying to get on, but I wanted to... He seems to have fallen asleep. Are you awake, Bill?
No, I'm like Trump. I'm sleeping at my trial.
Is it true you're in New York City right now on the jury?
Yeah, I'm in the couch right there in the judge's chambers. They have a special cot set up for Trump in case he comes in overtired. Yeah. They accommodate him in every way possible, you know.
It's amazing. He's sleepy Donald now instead of sleepy Joe. We have two sleepy candidates now.
Well, at least they're on an equal footing. We've leveled the playing field. We got two guys that are sound asleep. That's great. And the worst time possible, you know, when the whole world is caving in around them. You know?
That's true. That's absolutely true. All right. But we had a bumpy beginning. I wasn't sure if I was coming through or not on the meters here. But everything seems to be working now, and many thanks to our friend Mr. Edison.
Mr. Edison, for sure, man.
Who was awake during his show.
Oh, wide awake. And I tell you, I was sitting here all primed because I wanted to say, by what means do you select the musical pieces that you play? Because I was jumping and jiving and swinging and conniving. And the one thing I recognized in one of the... final two or three pieces that he played was that vast string of words that were put together, and none of them made sense. They weren't connected in no way at all, but they stimulated all sorts of thoughts in my mind. So I really felt that Mr. Edison was really priming the audience for me, you know, setting them up to be bewildered and startled by the stuff that I have to say. But he does quite a job. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, when John is in there, he sets a certain tone in my mind. And this Bill set an entirely different tone in my mind. And you can see the distinction between the various programmers that present their genres, you know.
Well, I think also that their main goal in life, Bill, John Tobacco and Mr. Edison, really is just to control your mind. I mean, I think that's their ultimate goal.
Well, see, it's so much better to be controlled by that than to be controlled by the system. Now, that's the underlying theme of my... I always try to come up with a theme for the day. Sometimes it's too obscure for me to pass it on to you listeners. But the idea of being controlled is playing a major role in my mind as I talk about events of the day, having been in the court, having been in the sit-ins, having been in these various places. You see, I'm seeing how systems go about controlling, and all of that is superimposed on the things that are connected to the music or other activities. Like, I'm so thrilled now with the 1 or 2 days that we had of sun, because my tulip bed burst out in beauty. And there they are, red and yellow and a few little purples pushing their beautiful blooms on us. So you see, that casts aside to a great extent, as does the spoken word, as does poetry, as does music. It casts off the restraints. Now, when I was listening to some of that real jivey stuff and I was beaten to it here, I thought to myself, if the radios are on in the post office, in the legislative bodies, in the offices of the university, in the IRS, and all those places where our USB signal penetrates, if people bring in their radios, the people would have to be up from their desks and dancing, and it would bring us to a new point, and we'd say, what the hell are you doing to us, folks, with all the other crap that you bestow on us, man? We got to get out of this mess. We got to get off this train and get our act together. And what better time to do it than now, you know, because there are issues before us that call for our collective response. And it'll not only be a response to this system that blankets us and isolates us and separates us, but it'll be a motivating force to draw us together and recognize each other. It'll enable us to recognize the diversity. They're all so upset about diversity and about the people who are coming who are not like them. And it's pathetic, because we the people get along fairly well. The reason we find it difficult to get along at times is because you are misdirecting us, and you are enabling us or causing us to cast aside our instincts to be good to one another. And we then fall into road rage, and we fall into this rage, and we fall into the division, and we follow some idiotic leader who wants to destroy everything around for his own personal gain. So anyway, on that note, I have to marvel at you two guys, how you kept your heads. I often feared when I was in the studio that something like that would happen to me, and I wouldn't know what button to push, what lever to pull. I would be, and of course, Cut was down the hall, and Bill could get hold of him. And
yeah, it was weird, because I wasn't sure if the problem was the setting over there or over here, because I wasn't seeing. Once we're on, I can see the levels. I can, you know, as I'm talking right now, and as you're talking, Bill, the meters are jumping here the same way you were jumping in your room there when Mr. Edison had control of your hearing facilities. You know,
I really was. Yeah.
So I wasn't sure what was happening. I think I'll have to go back and listen to see if the listeners in the radio audience were hearing us talk back and forth. But it was odd, but doesn't matter, because we're on now, and that's the most important thing.
Now.
And also, real quick, before we go full tilt boogie, is that we're in Radiothon, and I believe Mr. Edison is still in the studio. You can call and pontificate on the greatness of that is Mr. Edison to him himself. And and while you do that, you can make a pledge. The number is 631-632-6901. If you're afraid of that, because Mr. Edison is a very intimidating persona. He's radio, legendary radio DJ, you know, one of the greats. You could, if you're shy, you could just go on WUSB.FM and click on the pledge link and do it that way. And you will keep Mr. Edison, Bill McNulty, Cut Supreme, even Captain Phil. Yes, don't let that dissuade you. Even Captain Phil on the air. So,
well, you know that
love all the help music, you can give. Go ahead, Bill.
That music that Bill was playing, which it kind of suggested the spaceship attitude of your show. So everything was coming together before my very eyes.
The mothership was calling me.
Yeah, yeah. So it was good. It was very good. And you should check out, if you're not in the habit of listening to Mr. Edison, check out and make sure you know when he's on his regular slots, because he does a beautiful job. And strangely enough, I hadn't seen Mr. Edison quite some time. We used to cross paths very frequently when we were over in the old Student Union building. But fairly recently, we have a lot in common, Bill and I. Not only are we fellow programmers here at WUSB, but we share a doctor. And lo and behold, I'm in the office of this particular doctor, and I'm kind of scanning the room, and I catch the eye of a person across the way, and he sort of catches my eye, and lo and behold, we know one another. Who is it but Mr. Edison and Bill McNulty, right? So we sat together, and we shared stories, and we interacted, and then eventually the doctor came out. Hey, what's going on here? What kind of a meeting is this that we're holding in the waiting room, you see? So anyway, I was reminded of that as I was listening to Bill. So great. And now let's get going with a few things of more serious nature. I hope that you folks stayed tuned and didn't think that there was something wrong, that you should go away and involve yourself in something sensible. I hope you're staying nearby and can continue listening to the program for its duration. Well, maybe we'll just open up with a little bit of music. And I'm getting a little tired. Well, of a number of things. I'm getting tired of a number of things, but I'm getting tired of all this rain that we're having, you know, and it's kind of discouraging. And if you tend to buckle under the burden of what we are experiencing, all you need is a little gloomy, cloudy weather to catapult you even deeper. So maybe we can open up with a bit of a weather report that will lift our spirits in spite of the weather. Could we, I don't know if you're ready with some of those selections that I sent to you, Captain Phil, but if you are...
The captain is ready.
Oh, man, the captain is always ready. All right. Well, if we could just flip down to number 6, and we'll do a weather report before we get underway, and that may just, lighten
this would
up
be,
our...
This would be a Didn't It Rain, Children?
Yeah, Didn't It Rain. Isn't It Raining, Children? Isn't It Rain? Yeah, let's do that if we may.
Excellent. This is Sister Rosetta Tharpe on WUSB Stony Brook. It is Lunch on Thursday with Bill McNulty, also talking about radio legends Cut Supreme and Mr. Edison. That would have been an incredible waiting room to be in, Bill.
You said it. You said it. It was good.
Here we go. Didn't It Rain?
And the people are so sweet to stay here.
Oh, sweet.
And I come in on a...
Yeah.
Let me tell you what I come in on. Oh, yeah! Give me a key. Didn't it, you know it, didn't it? get in. I know it rain, you know it rain. Rain too long, all night long. Rain all day, rain all night. Rain, 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 children. Rain, oh yes, didn't it, yes. Didn't it, you know it did, didn't it. Oh my Lord, how it rain.
Okay, well, that's enough to make you almost forget about the fact that it's raining. That's a pretty good bit of music, I think, you know. Well, all right, let's go and start out today. Just keep in mind that overarching theme that I was talking about, and that is the idea that, you know, we're not always given the information that we should have, and the question is, why might that be? And I think I can say from my own experience, and I can suggest to you, that it is because there is always some need, perceived need, to keep the power structure intact, to keep the status quo in good order. And in order to do that, we have to be told certain things. We make reference to that when our attention is called to the need for transparency. And that's kind of a nice thing to think about, transparency. But there is an element of disinformation that is passed out. Because I think because these preservers of the status quo and of the well-being of the institution recognize that we can't trust the people with the truth, and we're just going to have to set up a structure that you know, will get us by and enable us to continue doing things in the same way. That thinking was best summed up by Chomsky when he wrote that book of Manufacturing Consent. In other words, we the people have to be managed, and in order to be managed, there are folks that will decide what it is that we should know and how we should be told about that subject that we should know. And that's where the problem comes in. And it's, in my view, it's most pressing right now, because what is plaguing us to a great extent, several things, but what is really setting the country into action is the situation in Gaza. All right, and it's being carried out by Israel. So you have the Palestinians and the Israelites. They've been in conflict for the last, 70 years, 1948, from 48 to present. And that once we kind of look at that carefully, which I hope we'll be able to do, I have two selections on the agenda for today, both of which are instructional. And they go into the history of that situation. And I'm going to play them. Each segment is about 12 minutes long. And we won't necessarily play them back to back. We'll play them when we're talking specifically about Gaza and about the horrors of what's going on there, which is being brought to us in our own immediate neighborhood by what's going on among the students here at the university. And what's going on with the students is going on all over the country, and to a much more serious way when people in huge numbers shut down an airport, when people in huge numbers shut down a bridge and block traffic. And when these huge numbers of people who are finally seeing through, I would say, even in spite of the misdirection and the misinformation and the promotion of ideas that it's decided they shouldn't have, they're breaking out. And when they break out, those protectors of the institution, of the status quo, of conventional wisdom, they do and they say some very serious things. Some of them legislate foolishly, based on ignorance. Some of them speak out of ignorance, suggesting, for example, that if people get in your way, maybe it's time that we should start throwing them off bridges. Now, that particular individual has impressed me as being one insipid individual from the very first time that I visualized him. He was an officer in the military. I think he probably was a second lieutenant. I don't know what rank he rose up to. But my only thought was, based upon my perception of him when I saw him do his thing, I thought, holy gee, if I ever had him as a commanding officer, I would have probably been locked up. I would have probably been court-martialed, because in spite of the strict confines of military order and discipline, you break out on that. You break out on that when you're taxed and when you can perceive characteristics with an individual that in your eyes make him unsuitable for leadership because of his nature. You know, it's very hard not to speak out. And maybe you should speak out. Anyway, that was Cotton from down in Arkansas. And down in the deep South, when you start talking about throwing people off the bridges, you're going back to the time when you said, let's hang them from trees. Let's burn them at the stake, if you will. Let's whip them to shreds. So that guy ought to wise up. And he has a cohort who has similar characteristics, and, you know, this idea of criticizing people for that. But, you know, when you display certain characteristics, you know, you're subject to. And the other guy is Hawley. I can't take that guy either. I have a lot of trouble with him. Shake your fist and be a big shot until it's time to run your fanny off to try to get out of the clutches of those people that you've aided and abetted in acting the way they did. So anyway, that's ties in with this idea of the status quo, you know. Okay, and I'm going to come back to that, and I want to spend time on the and maybe I should start right on that because I'm a lot out of time. As this thing is being demonstrated within our midst, the students here at Stony Brook spoke out. They spoke out, and maybe I'll just kind of go through a general review of that whole situation. On March 26th, Stony Brook University Police Department arrested seven students who were sitting in the common hall of the administration building in a sit-down protest in support of Palestine and divestment from Israel. It's broken out to the extent that they've taken a drastic, definite step to demonstrate what they've learned, what they know, and what the surrounding community doesn't acknowledge. The university has falsely claimed that the students were disrupting university activities, claiming that they were using a bullhorn, a drum, and loud chants. See, they weren't blocking bridges to prompting anybody to say, let's throw them off the edge. But activists were claiming that they were using a bullhorn, a drum, and a loud, but video footage and photographs and eyewitness accounts make it clear that prior to and during the arrest, students were calmly and a quiet sit-down protest. In response, a group of faculty led a second sit-in on March 27, 24, to draw attention to the criminalization of protest at Stony Brook, a flagship public university in the SUNY system. The faculty also wrote an open letter, which has generated over 600 signatures to date. And people were asked to sign that letter, and total numbers came up to about 600. And following a Senate meeting in which President McGinnis referred to the arrests as, quote, removal, unquote, of students to ensure law and safety without addressing any of the demands of the open letter, faculty, students, staff, and community members held a third sit-in April 3rd that saw no police presence or arrests, but still no engagement of the administration with the students or the faculty over the demands made in the letter. Our students will face disorderly conduct charges, still have a court date on April 15th, and are still facing disciplinary charges from the university, all for peaceful and lawful protest. Okay, that's how this thing has come to us in certainly in less threatening ways than what we've seen around the country. It's not an isolated event that occurred here and among a small number of students who were doing such terrible things as to disrupt the good order. That's how it's come to us. Now, when I got wind of it, I've been at these various events except the first one. I was not at the first one, but I was at the second one. I was at the third one, and I was at the court with the students that were arrested, and they were turned over to or taken into custody by Suffolk County Police. And as a result, their plight has been injected into the system, and they're now going before the court here in Suffolk County. So on the Monday of this week, I, with a few other members of the community, went to the court, and there we met up early in the morning, not too early, a few moments before entering the building, with the students. And I only had a few words to say to them when I saw them. I said, hey, are you nervous? Are you a little apprehensive? I said, well, don't be, you know. I said, you're performing a very significant task, and you've moved things to the next level of interaction with the system. You've gone from your own school setting. You've encountered the leadership of your school. They've chosen to bring you further along in the system, and here you are. So I said, go inside with your head high and recognize that you are part of a culture within America that has to do with free speech and has to do with your ability in a free country, which is seriously threatened now, folks. Let's not forget that. To stand up and register your dissatisfaction when you see something going on that requires your attention. And so they did. They entered, we entered, and it's quite an experience to go into court. If you haven't been there, it's one thing to sing the song, have you been to jail for justice? But it's another thing to just start out by saying, have you been to the court to witness people who are taking a stand for justice? That's a preliminary step. But it is the second level, and it is the opportunity for you as a member of the system, which sees fit to misdirect you sometimes. Sometimes you could argue that maybe it's good that you're not told the whole truth. I don't know. Credible deniability. What is that they say? You know, they structure their programs so that they have the ability to deny. Okay. But anyway, there we were in the court, and it is quite an experience. And you gather, and you're mixed in with other people. People are streaming into the Cohallen building and the federal building over there, too. You know, that court setting, that complex, it's a good place to learn a little bit about. You have the great white building, multi-story. I call it the White Sepulchre. We've been in that building on a number of occasions in the past to address issues of justice, to stand with others who have taken a stand which didn't meet the agreement of the enforcers. And then you have the Cohallen building, which administers the court. So you're in there with a mixture of people for alimony, back payments, traffic violations, lack of insurance, blah, blah, blah. And in addition, you have the various little corporate things that are necessary, businesses, paper signing, fraud here and there. It's nothing too great an extent. So anyway, there we were into the courtroom. And there was a lawyer. I have to compliment the students. They obtained a lawyer. I remember counseling with them by way of, I just communicated with them. This is what they do. I just talked to them, and I did at one point ask them via email if they had obtained a legal representation, and I had hoped that it would be pro bono. That's an interesting point in and of itself. I knew in my mind that if they had not considered that, I knew that I could make an effort to contact the lawyer that represented 25 of us way back in 1996 or seven. And that was Robert Gottlieb, who was a former candidate for district attorney here in Suffolk County. And he came to our rescue pro bono and spent 3 or 4 days in Georgia presenting a wonderful case, talking about the defense of necessity. The defense of necessity meaning that you acknowledge that you broke a law, but it was necessary to break your law because it was done to prevent the commission of a greater crime. So I learned that the students did obtain legal representation and that it was pro bono. And that was wonderful. That was a tribute to them because they found that route and recognized the importance of that. And Jonathan was the person that was there. And it was interesting. I had an opportunity to speak with him, and I found out that he had done a great deal of work with people in Syracuse. And in my brief conversation with him, I was able to say, I have friends in Syracuse. I was in Syracuse, in the federal court building there. And in the courtyard, or the park outside that federal building, I said, there is the Jerry Rescue statue. Do you know it? He didn't know it. Okay, but that's okay. But I want to just tell you about it. I've mentioned it before. The Jerry Rescue statue, it shows a jail with the door broken off its hinges. And it shows a black man, arms raised, chains still dangling from each wrist, but severed, being set free by the people of Syracuse to send that runaway slave on his continued journey to Canada for freedom. And in a sense, that was part in my mind of what was happening that day in the court in Islip. I also found out, and I asked this question not because I ever expected anybody in the category of student to be in a position to do it, but I said, suppose when you go before the judge in a case like this, which the court considers insignificant, they want to get back to. They want to get back to those cases that in many instances are bringing in fines for people. It's quite amazing to see the people coming there. But I did ask him, I said, suppose when the judge entertains a situation like this and offers to the perpetrator, to the accused, I am going to grant you a dismissal in anticipation of acquittal if you promise not to misbehave in the future. I said to the attorney, what would happen if a person in that category said, I'm sorry, Your Honor, with all due respect, I cannot accept your offer? He said, well, you'd be involved with further action. And I said, would it mean a trial? He said, yes. See, that's the next level. That's the next level of confronting the system, because then in a trial, there is the opportunity that you have to put your reasons before a jury of your peers. Of course, what happens in that case, since the courts don't want to hear a long-winded story about why you did the deed that you did, they don't want to hear that. They want to hear only a question. Did you do what you're accused of doing? Yes or no, period. They have a motion of ad limine, and my attention was roused because that was applied in the interactions at the present time over the one who is on trial, coincidentally, whose trial started on the very same date that those students had to be on Monday the 15th, the tax day. Time is not our, isn't there a lot of irony in that? Here's a man who did a lot of tax stuff and has never revealed his tax reports. He threatened to do it for 8 years and never did it. until the audit was over. Well, it looks to me like in his case, the audit is over to a certain extent. And now we're going to get the details. But anyway, that would be the next level. And that it's a tough route to go and not anybody. But I asked him that question primarily so I could have the opportunity to say that to my friends, that if you ever are in a position like that, that would be something you could do. See, that I was reminded of John Phillips. I was reminded of Susan. I can't remember Susan's list. I should remember. Both of them were arrested at a mall demonstration. John Phillips was arrested over in Melville when he occupied Hillary Clinton's office. Susan was arrested at the mall along with the deacon of the Miraculous Metal Church. And the deacon didn't go to trial, but didn't go to the court, but Susan did. And when she was offered that dismissal, and no, it was Susan. No, why can't I think of it? McKeon? Susan McKeon. She goes by another name now, and I can't remember that name. See, all these are events of the past, and my mind is I'm having trouble recalling some of the folks, you know. But I was interesting because I was able to say to the lawyer, oh, do you know so-and-so out in Matatuck? He comes from Matatuck now, out east. Yes, I do know him. Do you know so-and-so? Yes, yes. What about East End direction? What about East End Veterans Against the War? Do you know? Yes, I know the attorney. See, so I said, I can't remember the names, but see, the events come back 20 years, 25 years. Some things are forgotten. All the more reason to keep a journal. I should have been like Kavanaugh, kept a journal since he was 10. What are you doing? What's his name? First name? Bert? Brent? Oh, Mom, I'm writing the journal in the room. Oh, keep up the good work, son. Maybe someday you'll be on the Supreme Court. Anyway, yeah, and you can raise that issue during your confirmation year. I keep a journal. Okay, let's not get distracted. So anyway, I just said in case some people in our case, like Ron, and they could have done that. They could have done that. No, but neither one did. But that's okay. Because, you know, that's not an easy thing to do. You know, but these folks from the university are acting in the tradition of those who have gone down that path and have made history. And Stony Brook is noted for it. You know? And it's kind of also kind of interesting to know, in terms of the overarching theme about how we don't pay attention to history and we seem condemned, therefore, to repeat. And further irony, here we have an issue, Israel and Palestine, and it impacts the university. And way, way back in the 70s, when a professor came to Stony Brook and began teaching elements of the Israeli-Palestinian situation, was deemed unsatisfactory, not part of what was allowable. He was fired from his job. And the further irony of this is that at the time, when everybody came down on him to the point where he lost his job and in the course of defending himself, his house was firebombed, there was a person on staff at the university, this goes back to the 70s, whose name was Blinken. And ironically, his son is now running hither and yon in the Middle East, trying to put a lid on it. See, things are bursting forth, not only on the part of people who are seeing these issues for what they're worth, but bursting forth in connection with the two adversaries in this dispute. And the dispute is the age-old dispute of domination, of control. Whether you look at it from the standpoint of authorities who deem that loud noise is too much of a disturbance, to the point of making certain that you can overpower people who live in lands that you want to occupy fully and completely. So now on that note, maybe it would be a good time, maybe, and if it fits in with our reset situation, I would like to select on that separate email that I had sent you, Captain Phil. There were two selections, number two and number three. Number one, we're disregarding. We're not going into that one. That's not suitable for today. But both of those instances, two and three, they both deal with history of the Israeli-Palestinian question. And part of the problem is, and it's reflected in our Congress, it's reflected in our ruling bodies, in our people. We respect the rulers. We know that we have to have a society organized with persons. We can't have the anarchy, as appealing as anarchy might sound. And anarchy is not throwing bombs. Anarchy is just people regulating their own behavior. Well, we recognize that whereas that might work in a small body, and it might work in a larger body, but nonetheless, we recognize that society does call for a bit of an order, a bit of an order, plenty of order. See, we're experiencing order to the nth degree. And what we're talking about today is a breaking out of that, because we're saying, hey, look, you know, years ago, Mort McCluskey and I, Mort long gone, but not forgotten, we got together and we came up with an idea of waking people up. And it was a bumper sticker that said, "Do you smell one yet?" And it was a picture of a rat. "Do you smell a rat?" And we said, "New World Order." See, that was during the Bush years when he proclaimed, after kicking the Vietnam Syndrome, he proclaimed, "New World Order." And we said, "No, it's the New World Order." And so we had the bumper sticker, see. So the point is, we're beginning to recognize that these regulations which are imposed in many instances are imposed because of a predetermined agenda that wants to be set, that steps are taking to set, so the manufacturing consent takes place. You can't run a war unless people consent to it, and you can't run racial segregation unless people consent to it. But we're breaking out of it, and all the new elements, you can't outlaw transgendered people unless you manifest. Well, that's not going over so big. And you can't control women through the actions of one of your instruments when you put them under state control. We're breaking out of it. But the body says no. Arizona says no. We want to go back to a law that was passed before we were even a state. We want to go back to 1864. We want to make America great again and go back to the days of what, the covered wagon? How far back do you have to go? Well, just far enough to get rid of this group, that group, the other group, to put in place somebody who can dictate firmly and forcefully and powerfully, just like Putin, just like whoever, you know, Orban, just like the other guy over there in Turkey. Yeah, but we're saying no. No, why no? Because we have a system. We have a constitution. These people take oaths to it. I still want to know what the difference between the oath when you're in service that our current congressman took and the oath that he took when he's in that office that keeps him from speaking out against the insurrection that took place on January 6th. So all this is coming together. We're breaking out, folks. And now I just flash back to Bill. The last musical presentation. So music, we broke out, you know? We broke out. So anyway, would this be a good time to run one of those segments?
So I just want to state first that that the opinions expressed here on Lunch on Thursdays with Bill McNulty the people that gave them are not indicative of the station as a whole. That's just a little disclaimer. Which counts for every show on WUSB. But you have to state it sometimes. And yes, yeah. I have two and three loaded up here. I wasn't sure which one you wanted to start with.
It's kind of like, I think either one of them would be suitable. I know that second, number three, You know, talks about the British and their time in the area called Palestine. So maybe number three, and then we'll go back to number two if the time permits. It may not permit because we're branching into so many tentacles mm-hmm. Of these situations, you know. And honestly, you know, when you make a disclaimer, which is important to do, because I'm not thrusting anything down anybody's throat, but it's hard to believe that. And you know what? I could be convinced to go another direction too. But the point is, when you don't have the discussion, then you don't even have an opportunity. I may be wrong in every element of what I think, and I would be the first to admit it. But I would do that because I heard from the other side. I want to hear from the other side. I heard from the other side. Like when I was in the jail, I spent time with people when they did their service with the Torah, you see. And I have relatives by the name of Stein. I know a little bit about Uncle Joe, Aunt Gert. Aunt Gert drove an ambulance in World War I. Uncle Nat fought in World War I. Well, he didn't fought. He was a doctor. He healed in World War I. He healed in World War II. See, healing is the name of the game. So, you know, if you offend sensibilities, I don't want to offend anybody's sensibilities at all. I've done that when I've confronted the folks on the other side in so many different ways and so many different opportunities. I don't want to offend their sensibilities. I just would like to get into a discussion and hear why they feel the way they do. And then I would suggest why maybe that wasn't. And now I'm tempted to go into this event that happened, but we'll do it after this piece, we'll do it. But I want to go back to 1995, and I want to talk about the new documentary that's just out having to do with the bombing of the Oklahoma City. That was back in 1995. And now there's a documentary just out, and it's being promoted. And I want to talk about that. All right. But I don't want to get into that before we get out of this.
This is the origins of the Israel and Palestine conflict. This is like a little bit of a history here, and and it runs about 15 minutes long. So Bill and I are going to do a reset, and then we'll come back on the other side, and I will break in at 1 o'clock just to do a station ID. Otherwise, we'll just have this running.
Great.
So here we go, and Bill.
We'll start the reset right now when you're playing this.
Yep, and then we will hear from you in about 15 minutes.
All right, very good. Folks, you're getting a relief from me for 15 minutes.
The origins of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and this is a part one. There is a second part to this. We're just going to play part one here on Lunch on Thursday with Bill McNulty on WUSB Stony Brook. It is 12:55 in the p.m.
This is the Balfour Declaration. Signed in 1917, it set out British support for the creation of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. It's a famous document, a crucial piece of the puzzle in understanding today's conflicts in the Middle East, but it isn't the beginning of the story. In fact, when the Balfour Declaration was signed, the British had already promised this land to Arabs as an independent state, and promised the French government that it would be an internationally administered zone. And even then, most of the land was still under Ottoman control. So why did Britain make these three conflicting promises? How did it try to resolve them? And how did Britain's strategy in the Middle East help to cause a century of conflict?
How's that? Is that okay?
That's good. Yeah.
But turn of the 20th century, Britain's primary interest in the Middle East isn't oil. We might think of oil in the Middle East. They always sort of go together, especially now. But what we're really looking at then is an imperial lifeline. It's the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal is the quickest route from the empire, especially India, the jewel in the crown of the British Empire, to Britain. You don't have to go all the way around the Horn of Africa.
Britain had controlled Egypt since 1882 and believed that the Sinai Desert was enough of a buffer to defend the canal. But when the First World War began in 1914, the Ottoman Empire took Germany's side. In February 1915, the Ottomans launched a surprise attack across the desert to attack the Suez Canal.
It's easily beaten off by the British and Indian defenders, but the British are really worried that the Ottomans are going to use Sinai as a launch pad for further attacks on the canal. There's then a total mind change in British strategy back in London. There's stalemate on the Western Front, the Russians are collapsing into revolution, and the idea now is to look for a quick victory somewhere else away from France and Flanders. Lloyd George thinks Palestine is where we can do it. We can knock the Ottomans out of the war, but also the Suez Canal will be safe from any threat.
The area Britain had set its sights on was a larger one than today's Israel-Palestine, made up of different regions east and west of the River Jordan. There were small Christian and Jewish populations, but the majority were Muslim Arabs. After centuries of Ottoman rule, many Arabs now wanted a nation of their own.
Nationalism is growing across the multinational empires of Europe during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the Ottoman Empire is no stranger to this. The main reason for this is in 1908, there's a revolution within Turkey to try to strengthen and modernise the empire. It's called the Young Turk Revolution. And what happens is some very nationalistic Turks take over the government and are really into centralising and pushing the idea of Turkish identity. And this really starts to rile a lot of these Arab leaders. And this is where we start to get pan-Arab nationalism coming up and the idea of one independent land for all of those Arab peoples.
One of those leaders was Sharif Hussein of Mecca. In charge of the Islamic holy cities of Mecca and Medina, he was held in high regard by the local people. The British decided to use this to their advantage, promising him rulership over an independent Arab state if he rebelled against Ottoman rule. Sure enough, in 1916, the revolt began with Hussein's sons, Faisal and Abdullah, leading the fighting. As British and Commonwealth troops under General Allenby advanced through Palestine, Arab militia, with help from T.E. Lawrence, distracted the Ottomans.
This is a typical Arab headcloth, and it's accompanying a ghoul, which is the headband that you keep the headcloth firmly on your head. And these were actually worn by an Arab who took part in that Arab revolt up through the Hijaz and into Palestine and Syria towards the end of the war. This comes from the regular forces of the Sharifian army. These men were former Ottoman soldiers, and they volunteered to fight for Arab independence. And they were particularly important because of their previous military training and skills with modern weapons such as artillery and machine guns. So these men are the Arab forces. They attack lines of communication, they blow up railways, they attack small garrisons. And that makes it very difficult for the Ottomans to move troops and supplies around. And finally, of course, on the 1st of October 1918, Faisal and the Arab army have the honour of taking the surrender of Damascus.
But while the battle for Palestine was still raging, the British were doing secret backroom deals elsewhere. Between November 1915 and January 1916, British and French diplomats Mark Sykes and Francois